Cunningham. But I'm wondering, potentially, was this Burroughs fellow crouched down in the rear seat well, like some jailbreaker from a Peckinpah film? Scott turns off the TV. He is alone in the house now, standing naked in a white room, sun casting shadows on the floor. If he rations what he has, eats one meal a day, he can stay in this apartment for 6 days. Instead, he takes a shower, dresses for the day. Magnus, he thinks. If anyone talked, it was him. But when he calls Magnus, the Irishman claims ignorance. "Slow up," says Magnus. "What house is on television?" "I need you to rent me a car," Scott tells him after talking in circles around it. Magnus is uptown in what used to be Spanish Harlem, half in the bag, though it's only 10 in the morning. "You put in a good word, yeah?" says Magnus. "With Layla? Whispered a little something in that beautiful ear? Magnus is the best painter, something along those..." "Last night, I went on at length about your use of color and light." "Right on, boyo. Right feckin' on." She was hoping to come by this weekend, maybe see the new work. "I've gone full chubby," says Magnus. "Just in the last few seconds. The head is purple and engorged, like a snake bite." Scott crosses to the window. The curtains are sheer, but not see-through. Scott tries to look down, aware that people are out there looking back at him. He catches a glimpse of a second news van pulling into the curb. "Doesn't have to be a big car," he says. "I just need it for a couple of days to drive upstate."
"Want me to come?" says Magnus.
"No. I need you here," Scott replies, holding down the fort. "Layla likes to stay up all night, if you get my meaning."
"Consider it held, my friend. I've got enough Viagra to last until Halloween."
After they hang up, Scott grabs his jacket, walks into the living room, then stops short. In all the chaos, he has forgotten the hours he spent last night eradicating the white. He stands now in a cube of charcoal and lipstick, beet stains dried in ruby streaks. The Martha's Vineyard Farmer's Market surrounds him, a study for a painting in three dimensions, so that the room's furniture appears to be set in the middle of the open square. There is the fishmonger on the far wall, open coolers of ice below a long white card table, rows of vegetables, triple trays of berries, and faces, reconstructed from memory, sketched quickly with crumbling coal. And there, seated on a white canvas chair, is Maggie, her head and shoulders sketched on the wall, her body outlined on the fabric of the chair. She is smiling, eyes shadowed by a big summer hat. Her two children flank her on either side of the chair, the girl standing to her shoulder on the right. The boy, half obscured behind a side table on the left, just his tiny arm visible, attached to a slice of shoulder, a striped shirt, stripes the color of beets, stopping in the middle of his biceps, the rest of him hidden by wood. Scott stands frozen in the middle of this scene, out of time, surrounded by ghosts. Then he goes downstairs to face the crowd. Jack.
"I never liked to exercise," said Jack LaLanne. "But I like results."
This was clear from his triceps definition alone, not to mention the Clydesdale heft of his beer-barrel thighs. A man of average height, bursting at the seams of his short-sleeved jumpsuit. In his house, he kept an exercise museum, packed with obscure tech, most of it self-made. Jack invented the leg extension machine in 1936, you see. His approach was to work a muscle until it failed, believing, as he did, in the power of transformation through deep tissue annihilation. In the beginning, he wore a t-shirt and your standard pair of pants to train. He liked the feeling he got from stressing the weave. Then he had the idea to display himself in fitted jumpsuits, a uniform of self-improvement, so he went to the Oakland Pants Factory. He gave them sketches, an array of color choices, blues and grays, mostly. An African-American woman took his measurements with a cloth tape, rolling around him on a squeaky metal chair. In those days, wool was the only fabric that would stretch,
and so they made the jumpsuits out of that, milled as thin as the material would allow. Jack liked them shiny, he told her, peacocking, and sleeveless, to show his rolling arms, and tapered at the waist. Jack wore them so tight you could see what he ate for breakfast. A local health store paid Jack to create a local access show for KGO-TV. He taught people about the power of diet, designing workouts for every muscle, from toe to tongue. 6 years later, the show went national. People ate breakfast to images of Jack bouncing on his tiptoes. They ran in front of their television, aping what they saw, bending at the waist and rotating their arms in bird-like windmills. As things picked up steam, certain words and phrases entered the American lexicon. Jumping jack, squat thrust, leg lift. His jumpsuits had a tone-on-tone belt that cinched at the waist. In his prime, Jack was a square-jawed hourglass of a man, his ink-black shag cut into a classic Italian wave on his head. Frankie Valli, for example. To most people in the early years, he existed only in black and white, an ethnic fireplug pointing at anatomy charts, explaining what went on inside the human body. See, he seemed to say, we're not just animals. We are architecture, bones and sinew and ligament as a foundation for a rolling musculature. Jack showed us that everything about the human anatomy was connected and could be used in glorious tandem. To smile was to use an entire system of muscles, powered by joy. One day he showed Americans how to get their faces athletic-looking, opening and closing his mouth comically wide to the take-me-out-to-the-ball-game lilt of a sports organ. Then, in the 1970s, Jack went full color, bounding onto a wood-paneled set in shiny blues and purples. He became a kind of talk show host, interviewing bodybuilders about diet and lifestyle. It was the era of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Vietnam had been lost, American men had walked on the moon, and Nixon seemed poised to resign in disgrace. You tuned in because you liked his boundless energy. You tuned in because you were tired of looking down and seeing your own stomach. You tuned in to get your heart rate moving and turn your life around. Now, direct from Hollywood, boomed the announcer, here's your personal health and fitness instructor, Jack LaLanne. For 30 minutes, what you got was can-do gumption. You got a corporate-sponsored attitude adjustment. You got mountains to climb. Inspiration. You got skills. Isn't it better to be happy with a problem, he said, than to be miserable with it? Don't wallow, Jack told a nation stumbling under recession. When life gets hard, you need to get harder. This was during Jack's inspirational phase when he realized that what people needed was not just a muscular regimen, but a better way of looking at the world. The network would throw back from commercials, and there he'd be, the jumping jack man, sitting backward on a metal chair, laying down the science. You know, he'd say, there are so many slaves in this country. Are you a slave? You're probably saying, Jack, how can you be a slave in this wonderful free country of America? I don't mean a slave in the idea that you're thinking of it. I'm talking about you're a slave when you can't do the things you want when you want to do them. Because you are a slave, just like the slaves of old who were captured and put in chains. They were shackled, you know, and not allowed to go anyplace. Jack looked directly into the lens. You're a slave just about as much as that. And at this point, he leaned forward and pointed right at the camera, enunciating each syllable. You're a slave to your own body. The mind, said Jack, remains active until the day you die, but it is a slave to the body. Bodies that had become so lazy, all they want to do is sit. The dawn of the couch potato, and you've allowed it to be that way. Instead of you ruling your body, he said, your body is ruling you. It was the dawn of the television age, and already the lethargy had set in, that flicker-glow hypnotism. The idiot box. And here was Jack speaking truth to power, trying to break you from the smothering shackles of the modern world. "This is not complicated shit," he told you with his eyes, the movement of his body seeming to answer every question he asked. No French philosopher, living or dead, could convince Jack LaLanne that the problems of man were existential. It was a matter of will, of perseverance, of mind over matter. Where Sartre saw ennui, Jack saw energy. Where Camus saw pointlessness and death, Jack saw the board-breaking power of repetition. Jack rose to power in the era of Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, the age of John Wayne. America was the go-getter nation, as far as he was concerned. There was no challenge too great, no obstacle too big. Jack told us that America was the nation of the future, that we were all on the verge of traveling to a science fiction nirvana in gleaming rocket ships. Except, as far as Jack was concerned, we should be running there. Imago. He is assaulted by artificial light, framed by cameras with halogen spots. Scott squints reflexively, ensuring that the first image the world sees of him is of a man wincing slightly, left eye bowed in squint. Bodies surge forward as he steps from the front door, men with shoulder-mounted cameras and women with bald microphones trailing cords across the gum-stained sidewalk. "Scott!" they say. "Scott! Scott!" He settles in on the threshold, door half open, in case he needs an easy escape. "Hello," he says. He is a man starting a conversation with a crowd. Questions are hurled toward him, everybody speaking at once. Scott thinks of what this street once was, a forested stream winding toward a muddy river. He holds up his hand. "What's the goal here?" he asks. "Just a few questions," says one of the journalists. "I was here first," says another, a blonde woman holding a microphone with the letters ALC embossed on a rectangular box. Her name, she says, is Vanessa Lane, and she has Bill Cunningham speaking into her ear from Mission Control. "Scott," she says, pushing to the front, "what are you doing here?"
"Here on this street?" he asks.
"With Ms. Mueller. Is she a friend of yours? Or more, maybe?" Scott thinks about this. Is she a friend, or more, maybe? He's not sure what the question means, really.
"I'd have to think about that," he says. "Whether we're friends. We just met, really. And then there's her point of view, how she sees things, because maybe I get it wrong, the meaning, which, who hasn't done that before, thinking something is black when it's really white?"
Vanessa frowns. "Tell us about the crash," she says. "What was it like?"
"In what sense?"
"Out there alone, the raging ocean, and then you hear the boy crying." Scott thinks about this, his silence peppered by other questions shouted in 5/6 time.
"You're looking for a comparison. This is like that. An analogy to help you understand."
"Scott," yells a brunette with a microphone, "why did the plane crash? What happened?"
A young couple approaches from the east. Scott watches as they cross the street to avoid the spotlight. He is the accident now, rubbernecked by pedestrians. "I suppose I'd have to say it was like nothing," Scott tells Vanessa, not ignoring this new question, but simply focused on the last. "Certainly there's no comparison for me. The size of the ocean, its depth and power, a moonless sky. Which way is north? Survival at its basest form isn't a story, or, I don't know, maybe it's the only story."
"Have you spoken to the boy?" someone shouts. "Was he scared?"
Scott thinks about that. "Wow," he says. I don't know that that's a question for me to the 4-year-old brain. I mean, that's an entirely different conversation. I know what the experience was for me, a speck in a vast and hostile darkness, but for him, at this moment in development, biologically, I mean, and with the nature of fear, at a certain level, the animal power of it, but again, at his age..."
He breaks off, thinking, aware that he is not giving them what they want, but concerned that their questions are too important to answer in the moment, to define in passing, simply to meet some kind of arbitrary deadline. What was the experience like?
Why did it happen? What does it mean going forward? These are subjects for books. They are questions you meditate over for years to find the right words, to identify all the critical factors, both subjective and objective. It's an important question, he says, and one we may never really know the answer to. He turns to Vanessa. I mean, do you have kids? She is 26 at most.
No.
Scott turns to her cameraman in his 40s. You?
Yeah, a little girl.
Scott nods. And see? Then there's gender, and the time of night, how he was asleep when the plane went down, and did he think it was a dream, maybe? At first? Like maybe he was still sleeping? So many factors.
People say you're a hero, shouts a third reporter.
Is that a question?
Do you think you're a hero?
You'd have to define the word for me, says Scott. Plus, what I think doesn't really matter. Or, that's not true. What I think about myself hasn't always proven to be accurate, according to the world at large. Like how in my 20s I thought I was an artist, but really I was just a kid in his 20s who thought he was an artist. Does that make sense?
Scott!
They shout. I'm sorry, says Scott. I can tell I'm not giving you what you want.
Scott, says Vanessa, this is from Bill Cunningham directly. Why were you on that plane?
You mean in a cosmic sense, or
how did you end up on the plane?
She says, correcting herself. Maggie invited me.
Maggie is Margaret Bateman, wife of David.
Yes.
And were you having an affair with her, with Mrs. Bateman?
Scott frowns. Like a sexual affair?
Yes. Just as you are now having an affair with Ms. Mueller, whose father donates millions to liberal causes.
Is that a real question?
People have a right to the truth.
Just because I've been inside her house, you're saying I've had... that she and I have had sex. This is your Einstein conclusion?
Isn't it true that you wooed your way onto that plane?
In order to what? Crash into the sea and have to swim 10 miles to shore with a busted shoulder? He feels no anger, just bafflement at the line of questioning.
Isn't it true the FBI has questioned you multiple times?
Does two count as multiple?
Why are you in hiding?
You say in hiding like I'm John Dillinger. I'm a private citizen living his life in private.
You didn't go home after the crash. Why not?
I'm not sure.
Maybe you feel you've got something to hide.
Staying out of sight is not the same thing as hiding, says Scott. I miss my dog, that's for sure.
Tell us about the paintings. Is it true the FBI has seized them?
No. Not that I... They're just pictures. A man stands in a shed on an island. Who knows why he paints what he paints? He feels like his life is a disaster. Maybe that's where it starts. With irony. But then, he sees something greater there. A key, maybe, to understanding.
Is this... Am I answering your... Is it true you painted a plane crash?
Yes, that's one of the... It feels like to me, I mean, we're all gonna die. That's biology. All animals. But we're the only ones that know. And yet we... Somehow we manage to put this profound knowledge into some kind of a box. We know, but at the same time we don't. And yet, in these moments of mass death... A ferry sinks, a plane crashes. We are brought face to face with the truth. We too will die one day, and for reasons that have nothing to do with us, our hopes and dreams. One day you get on a bus to go to work and there's a bomb, or you go to Walmart looking for savings on Black Friday and get crushed by a mob. So what started as irony, my life, the disaster, opened a door. He chews his lip, but the man in the shed is still just a man in a shed, you know? Vanessa touches the plastic in her ear.
Bill would like to invite you to come to the studio for a one-on-one interview.
That's nice of him, says Scott. I think. Except the look on your face doesn't seem like you're being nice. More like the police.
People are dead, Mr. Burroughs, she says. Do you really think now is the time for nice?
now more than ever, he tells her, then turns and walks away. It takes a few blocks, but eventually they stop following him. He tries to walk normally, aware of himself both as a body in space and time and as an image viewed by thousands. Millions? He takes Bleecker to 7th Avenue and jumps in a cab. He is thinking about how they found him. A man in a locked apartment with no cell phone. Layla says she didn't talk, and he has no reason to doubt her. A woman with $1 billion doesn't lie unless she wants to, and from the way she acted, it seemed like Layla liked having Scott as her own little secret. And Magnus, well, Magnus lies about a lot of things, but this doesn't feel like one of them. Unless they gave him money, but then why did Magnus end their phone call by hitting Scott up for $100? The universe is the universe, he thinks. I suppose it is enough to know there is a reason without having to know what it is. Some new kind of satellite, maybe? Software that burrows into our bones while we sleep? Yesterday's science fiction becomes today's IPO. He was an invisible man, and now he's not. What matters is that he runs toward something and not away. Sitting in the back of a cab, Scott pictures the boy eating cereal in front of the television late at night, unable to sleep, watching a dog drawn from the letters D-O-G talk to a cat drawn from the letters C-A-T. If only life were that simple, where everyone we met and every place we went was fashioned from the pure essence of its identity, where you looked at a man and saw the letters F-R-I-E-N-D, and looked at a woman and saw the word W-I-F-E. The screen is on in the cab, playing clips from late-night television. Scott reaches forward and turns it off. Gil Baruch, June 5th, 1967 to August 23rd, 2015. There were legends about him, stories, but more than stories. Theories might be a better word. Gil Baruch, 48, Israeli expat, though one of the theories was that he owned a home on the razor's edge of the West Bank, an edge he himself had forged single-handedly from Palestinian land, driving up one day in an old jeep and setting up his tent, enduring the stares and taunts of the Palestinians. Rumors he had chopped the wood himself, poured the foundation, a rifle strapped over his chest. That the first house had been torched by an angry mob, and Gil, rather than using his prodigious sniper skills or hand-to-hand prowess, had simply watched and waited. And when the crowd dispersed, he urinated his disdain into the ashes and started again. That he was the son of Israeli royalty, no one disputed, his father Lev Baruch being the trusted right hand of Moshe Dayan, renowned military leader, mastermind of the Six-Day War. They say Gil's father was there in 1941 when a Vichy sniper put a bullet through the left lens of Dayan's binoculars, that it was Gil's father who cleaned out the glass and shrapnel and stayed with Dayan for hours until they could be evacuated. They said Gil was born on the first day of the Six-Day War, that his birth coincided with the opening shot down to the second. Here was a child forged in war from the loins of a military hero born of cannon recoil. Not to mention, people said, that his mother was the favorite granddaughter of Golda Meir, the only woman tough enough to forge an entire nation inside the belly of an Arab state. But then there were others who said Gil's mother was just a milliner's daughter from Kiev, a pretty girl with a wandering eye who never left Jerusalem. This is the nature of legend. There's always someone lurking in the shadows trying to poke holes. What's undisputed is that his oldest brother Eli was killed in Lebanon in 1982, and that both his younger brothers Jay and Ben were killed in the Gaza Strip during the Second Intifada, Jay annihilated by a landmine, and Ben in an ambush. And that Gil lost his only sister in childbirth. This was part of the legend, that Gil was a man surrounded by death, that everyone close to him died sooner rather than later, and yet Gil prevailed. He was rumored to have been shot 6 times before turning 30, to have survived a knife attack in Belgium, and to have shielded himself from an explosion in Florence by hiding in the belly of a cast-iron tub.
Snipers had targeted him and missed. Bounties on his head, too numerous to list, went perpetually uncollected. Gil Baruch was an iron nail in a burning building, left gleaming in the ashes after everything else had been destroyed. And yet all that death and sorrow hadn't gone unnoticed. There was a biblical quality to the travails of Gil Baruch. Even in Jewish terms, his suffering was exceptional. Men would clap him on the back in bars and buy him drinks, and then remove themselves to a safe distance. Women laid themselves at his feet, as they would on the tracks of a train, hoping that in the collision of bodies they would be annihilated. Crazy women with fiery tempers and bountiful G-spots. Depressive women. Fighters. Biters. Poets. Gil ignored them all. At his core, he knew that what he needed in his life was less drama, not more. And yet the legends prevailed. During his tour in private security, he had bedded some of the most beautiful women in the world, models, princesses, movie stars. There was a theory, prominent in the 1990s, that he had taken Angelina Jolie's virginity. He had the olive skin, hawk nose, and heavy brow of a great romantic. He was a man with scars, both physical and emotional, scars he carried without complaint or remark. A taciturn man with a glint of the ironic in his eyes, as if deep down he knew he was the butt of a cosmic joke. A man who carried weapons and slept with a gun under his pillow, his finger on the trigger. They said a man had not yet been born that Gil Baruch could not best. He was an immortal who could only be killed by an act of God. And yet what else can one call a plane crash, except the fist of God sent to punish the bold? He had been with the family for 4 years, joining their detail when Rachel was 5. It had been 3 years since the kidnapping, 3 years since David and Maggie felt the cold chill of discovery, an empty crib, an open window, in the middle black of night. Gil slept in what old-world architects would have called the maid's quarters, a monk's cell behind the laundry room in the city, and a larger room facing the driveway on the vineyard estate. Depending on the current threat level, ascertained from email analysis as well as conversations with foreign and domestic analysts, both private and in the government, based on the current mélange of extremist threats and the controversial nature of current ALC network programs, Gil's support team grew and shrank, numbering at one point, after the 2006 Iraq surge, a dozen men with tasers and automatic weapons. But baseline, there were always three. A trinity of eyes watching, calculating, coiled and ready to act. Their travel was planned in the home office, always in consultation with the on-site team. Commercial flights were no longer optimal, nor was public transportation, although Gil indulged David's desire to ride the subway to the office a few times a month, but never in any kind of pattern, a day chosen at random, and on those days they first sent a decoy in the town car, exiting the building dressed in David's clothes, head down, hurried out by his team, and stuffed into the back seat. On the subway, Gil stood far enough from David to let him feel like a man of the people, but close enough to intervene if outside agents chose to strike. He stood with his thumb resting on the hilt of a curved folding blade hidden on his belt, a blade so sharp it could cut paper, and was rumored to be poisoned with the venom of the molten brown recluse. There was a small semi-automatic pistol tucked somewhere undetectable, one David had seen his body man pull once without seeming to move. A homeless man charged them screaming outside the Time Warner building, holding some kind of pipe, and David took a fast step back, looking to his aid. 1 minute Gil's hand was empty. The next, he held a snub-nosed Glock, which he produced from the ether like a magician, revealing a dull and scarred coin. Gil liked the rocking of the subway, the corner shriek of metal on metal. He had a deep, marrow certainty that his life would not end underground. It was an instinct he had learned to trust. Not that he feared death. There were so many people he had lost, so many familiar faces now waiting for him on the other side, if there was another side and not just tar-black silence. But even that didn't sound bad, an end to the Sisyphean immensity of life. At least the eternal question would be answered once and for all. The Torah, it should be noted, makes no clear reference to the afterlife whatsoever. As he did every morning, Gil rose before dawn. It was the fourth Sunday in August, the family's last on the vineyard. They had been invited to Camp David for the Labor Day weekend, and Gil had spent much of yesterday coordinating security with the Secret Service. He spoke four languages, Hebrew, English, Arabic, and German, joking that it was important for a Jew to know the language of his enemies, so he could tell when they were plotting against him. This joke, of course, was lost on most listeners. It was the look on his face when he told it, like a mourner at a funeral. The first thing Gil did after he rose was change his status to active. He did it instantly, the moment his eyes opened. At most, he slept 4 hours a night. Waiting an hour or two after the family went to sleep, and rising an hour or two before they woke. He liked that quiet time when the lights were out, sitting in the kitchen, listening to the mechanical hum of the appliances, the trigger click of the HVAC as it engaged to cool or heat the house. He was a master of immobility, having sat still, the legend went, for 5 days straight on a Gaza roof deep inside enemy territory, his Barrett M82 balanced on metal legs, waiting for a high-value target to emerge from an apartment complex, the threat of discovery by Palestinian forces a constant. Compared with that, sitting in the air-conditioned luxury kitchen of a multimillionaire's estate was like an ocean cruise. He sat with a thermos of green tea. No one ever saw him make it. Eyes closed, listening. As opposed to the domestic craziness of the waking day, the night sounds of a house, even a big one like this, were consistent and predictable. The house was wired, of course, sensors on all the windows and doors, motion detectors, cameras. But that was technology, and technology could be tricked, disabled. Gil Baruch was old school, a sensualist. Some said he wore a garrote for a belt, but no one had ever seen the proof. The truth was, when Gil was a child, he and his father fought all the time, about everything. Gil was the middle child, and by the time he was born, the paterfamilias was already well on his way to drinking himself to death, which he did in 1991, when cirrhosis became heart failure, and heart failure became silence. And then, according to the Torah, Gil's father ceased to be, which was just fine with Gil, who sat now in the air-conditioned kitchen and listened to barely audible hush of the surf as it pounded the beach outside. The security logs from that Sunday were unremarkable. The husband, Condor, stayed home, read newspaper 8:10 a.m. to 9:45, napped in upstairs guest room 12:45 to 1:55, made and received several phone calls 2:15 to 3:45, prepared and cooked supper 4:30 to 5:40 p.m. The wife, Falcon, went to the farmer's market, accompanied by Rachel and a body man, Avram. The boy played in his room and had a soccer lesson. He napped from 11:30 to 1. Anyone looking back at the log later, trying to piece together a mystery, would find nothing but times and dry entries. It was a lazy Sunday. What made it meaningful were not the facts or details, but the imperceptibles. Inner life. The smell of the beach grass and the feel of sand on a bathroom floor when changing out of a swimsuit. The heat of American summer. Line 10 of the log read simply, 10:22, Condor 8-second breakfast. It couldn't capture the perfect toasting of the onion bagel or the saltiness of the fish in contrast with the thickness of cream cheese. It was time lost in a book, a journey of imagination, transportation, which to others simply looks like sitting or lying stomach down on the rug in front of a summertime fire, legs bent at the knees, up 90 degrees, kicking absently, feet languid in the air. To be a body man did not mean being in a state of constant alarm. In fact, it was the opposite. One had to be open to changes in the way things were, receptive to subtle shifts, understanding that the frog was killed not by being dropped into boiling water, but by being boiled slowly, 1 degree at a time. The best body men understood this. They knew that the job required a kind of tense passivity, mind and body in tune with all 5 senses. If you thought about it, private security was just another form of Buddhism, Tai Chi. To live in the moment, fluidly, thinking of nothing more than where you are and what exists around you. Bodies in space and time moving along a prescribed arc. Shadow and light. Positive and negative space. In living this way, a sense of anticipation can evolve, the voodoo pre-knowledge that the wards you are watching are going to do or say something expectable. By being one with the universe, you become the universe, and in this way, you know how the rain will fall, the way cut grass will blow in fixed starts in a summer wind. You know when condor and falcon are about to fight, when the girl, Rachel, Robin, is getting bored, and when the boy, JJ, Sparrow, has missed his nap and is going to melt down. You know when the man in the crowd is going to take 1 step too close, when the autograph fan is, instead, looking to serve legal papers. You know when to slow down on a yellow light, and when to take the next elevator. These are not things you have feelings about. They are simply things that are. Falcon was up first, in her robe, carrying Sparrow. The machine had already made coffee. It ran on a timer. Rachel came down next. She went straight to the living room and put on cartoons. Condor was up last, an hour later, shuffling in with the newspaper, thumbs digging into the blue Sunday plastic bag. Gil lurked, staying out of the way, eyes on the periphery, hugging the shadows. After breakfast, he approached Condor.
"Mr. Bateman," he said, "okay if I brief you now?"
Condor looked up over his reading glasses.
"Should I be worried?"
"No, sir. Just an overview for the week."
Condor nodded, stood. He knew Gil didn't like to talk shop in casual settings. They went into the parlor. It was lined with books that Condor had actually read. Old maps lined the walls, photos of Condor with notable global figures, Nelson Mandela, Vladimir Putin, John McCain, the actor Clint Eastwood. There was an autographed baseball in a glass case on the desk. Chris Chambliss's 10th-inning blast from that game, because who in the tri-state area didn't remember the way the stands emptied onto the field, the way Chambliss had to push and twist through civilian lunatics to round the bases? Did he even touch home plate?
"Sir," said Gil, "would you like me to get Command Central on the line to do a more formal briefing?"
"God, no. Just run it down for me." Condor sat behind his desk, picked up an old football. He juggled it mindlessly, hand to hand, as Gil spoke.
16 email threats intercepted," he began, "sent to mostly public addresses. Your private lines seem uncompromised since our last reshuffle. At the same time, corporate is tracking some specific threats against American media companies. They're working with Homeland Security to stay up to the moment."
Condor studied him as he spoke, spiraling the ball from left to right and back.
"You were in the Israeli army?"
"Yes, sir."
"Infantry, or—" "That's not something I can talk about. Let's say I did my duty, and let that be that."
Condor flipped the ball. Missed the catch. It bounce-rolled in a sloppy parabola, settling under a curtain.
"Any direct threats?" he asked. "David Bateman, we're going to kill you? That type of thing?"
"No, sir. Nothing like that."
Condor thought about it.
"But okay. So this guy, the one we don't talk about who took my girl, when did he ever make a threat against a media conglomerate or send a bullshit email? This was a scumbag who thought he could get rich and didn't mind murdering the maid."
"Yes, sir."
"And what are you doing to protect us from those guys, the ones who don't make threats?"
If Gil felt dressed down, he didn't show it. To him, it was a fair question.
"Both homes are secure. Cars are armored. Your protection detail is visible, high profile. If they are looking for you, they see us.
We are sending a message. There are easier targets.
But you can't guarantee.
No, sir.
Condor nodded. Conversation was over. Gil headed for the door.
Oh, hey, said Condor. Mrs. Bateman invited the Kiplings to fly back with us later.
Is that Ben and Sarah?
Condor nodded.
I'll let Command know, said Gil.
The key to being a good body man, he had decided over the years, was to be a mirror. Not invisible. The client wanted to know you were there, but reflective. Mirrors weren't intimate objects. They reflected change. Movement. A mirror was never static. It was the part of your environment that shifted with you, absorbing angle and light. And then, when you stood flush in front of it, it showed you yourself.
He had read the file, of course. What kind of bodyguard would he be if he hadn't? The truth was, he could quote certain sections from memory. He had also spoken to the surviving agents at length, looking for sensory details, for information on how the principals comported themselves. Was Condor calm under pressure or explosive? Did Falcom succumb to panic and grief, or did she show a mother's steel? The kidnapping of a child was the nightmare scenario in his line of work, worse than a death, though, to be realistic, a kidnapped child was, 9 times out of 10, a dead child. But a kidnapped child removed the normal human safety mechanisms from a parent's mind. Survival of the self was no longer a concern. Protection of wealth, of home, became secondary. Reason, in other words, went out the window. So mostly what you fought with in the kidnap and ransom scenarios, other than the clock, were the principles themselves. The facts at the time of Robin's kidnapping were these. 24 hours earlier, the nanny, Francesca Butler, Frankie, had been taken, most likely while traveling on foot on her way home from the movies. She had been coerced at a second location to share information about the Batemans' rental home and routines. Most important, which room was the baby girl in? On the night of the abduction, between 12:30 and 1:15 a.m., a ladder had been removed from a shed on the property and propped against the south wall, extending to the lip of the guest room window. There were signs that the window lock had been jimmied from the outside. It was an old house with original windows, and over the years they had swollen and shrunk until there was a healthy gap between the upper and lower frames. Later, investigators would conclude that the kidnapping was the work of a single perpetrator, though there was some dispute. And so the official story was that one man set the ladder, climbed up, retrieved the girl, and took her back down. The ladder was then re-stowed in the shed. What had he done with the child? Placed her in a car? And the child removed from the property. In the words of the principals, she disappeared. But of course, Gil knew that no one really disappeared. They were always someplace, bodies at rest or in motion in three-dimensional space. And in this case, where this single kidnapper had taken Rachel Bateman, a.k.a. Robin, was across the street, to the stalled modern remodel, hidden away behind plastic, to a sweltering attic space, soundproofed with newspaper, where food came out of a plastic red cooler and water from a hose connected to a second-floor bathroom sink. The nanny, Frankie Butler, lay dead in the open foundation, covered with cardboard. It was from this spot that the kidnapper, a 36-year-old ex-con named Wayne R. Macy, watched the comings and goings across the street. From his vantage point in the future, Gil knew that Macy was not the criminal mastermind they first thought they were dealing with. When you have a principal like David Bateman, worth millions, as well as a high-profile political target, you must assume that the child's kidnapper has targeted the principal for specific reasons, with full knowledge of his profile and resources. But the fact is, all Macy knew was that David and Maggie Bateman were rich and unprotected. He had done a stretch in Folsom Prison in the 1990s for armed robbery, and had come home to Long Island with the idea that he might turn his life around. But straight life was punishing and unrewarding, and Wayne liked his booze, and so he burned through job after job until finally one day, hauling trash bags out of the back of the Dairy Queen, he had decided, "Who am I kidding? It's time to take my fortune into my own hands."
So he set out to grab a rich man's kid and make a few dollars. Details came out later that he had cased two other families first, but certain factors, the husbands were on the premises full-time, both houses had alarm systems, deterred him from acting, and ultimately steered him to settle on a new target, the Bateman family. The last house on a quiet street, unguarded, populated by two young women and a child. The consensus was that he had killed Frankie that first night, after getting all the information out of her he could. There were signs of physical cruelty, and also evidence of sexual assault, possibly posthumous. The child was taken at 12:45 a.m. on July 18th. She would be missing for 3 days. The word came back as they were already in transit. Command relayed it to the lead car, and the lead car transmitted it to Gil, who listened to the voice in his ear, speaking to him through fiber and void, without betraying anything.
"Sir," he said in a certain tone of voice as the car left their road.
Condor looked over, saw Gil's expression, nodded. Behind them, the kids were animated, like push-button toys. They always got this way before getting on the plane, excited, nervous.
"Kids," he said with a look on his face.
Maggie saw it. "Rachel," she said, "that's enough." Rachel sulked, but stopped the game of poke and tickle. JJ was too young to get the message the first time. He poked Rachel and laughed, thinking they were still playing.
"Stop,"
she whined. Condor leaned over to Gil, who closed the gap, speaking quietly into Condor's ear.
"There's a problem with your guest," he said.
"Who?
Kipling?" said Condor.
"Yes, sir. Command did a routine check and a flag came back."
Condor didn't respond, but the question was implicit. What flag?
"Our friends in state are saying Mr. Kipling may be indicted tomorrow."
The blood drained from Condor's face.
"Jesus," he said. "The actual charges are sealed, but research thinks he may be laundering money for non-friendlies."
Condor thought about that. Non-friendlies. Then it hit him. He was about to host an enemy of the state on his plane. A traitor. How would that look in the press if the press found out? Condor pictured the bored paparazzi at Teterboro waiting for all the celebrity returns. They would stand when the plane taxied in, then, when it was clear Brad and Angelina weren't on board, they'd snap a few photos just in case and go back to their iPhones. Photos of David Bateman, arm in arm with a traitor.
"What do we do?" he asked Gil.
"Up to you."
Falcon was looking at them, clearly worried.
"Is there something?" she said.
"No," Condor told her quickly. "Just, it looks like Ben's in some legal trouble."
"Oh, no."
"Yeah, bad investments. So I was just, the question comes up for me, do we want to, if we're seen together, after the news comes out, are we going, it could be a headache is all I mean."
"What's Daddy saying?"
Rachel asked. Falcon was frowning.
"Nothing. Just a friend of ours is having some trouble, so we're going to..."
This, directed at Condor, "we are going to stand by him because that's what friends do. Sarah, especially, is just such a lovely person." Condor nodded, wishing now that he'd dodged the question and handled things privately.
"Of course," he said. "You're right."
He looked forward, met Gil's eye. The Israeli had a look on his face which implied he needed direct confirmation that they were going with the status quo. Against his better judgment, Condor nodded. Gil turned and looked out the window as they talked. It wasn't his job to be part of things, to have opinions. On the road, he could see the marine layer hanging low, lampposts vanishing into the mist. Only a hoary glow at height indicated they were whole. 20 minutes later, parked on the tarmac, Gil waited for the lead car to disgorge the advance team before he gave the okay to exit. The two lead men were scanning the airfield for irregularities. Gil did the same, trusting them and not trusting them at the same time. As he reviewed the area, entrance points, blind spots, the family climbed from the car. Sparrow was asleep by this point, draped across Condor's shoulder. Gil made no offer to help carry bags or children. His job was to protect them, not to valet. From the corner of his eye, Gil saw Avram sweep the plane, climbing the deployable stairs. He was inside for 6 minutes, walking fore to aft, checking the washroom and the cockpit. When he emerged, he gave the high sign and descended. Gil nodded.
Okay, he said.
The family approached the gangway, boarding in random order. Knowing the plane was swept clear, Gil was the last to board, protecting against attack from the rear. He could feel the chill of the cabin before he was halfway up, a ghostly kiss on his exposed neck, cutting through the August musk. Did he feel something stir in his lizard brain in that moment? A low foreboding? A wizard's sense of doom? Or is that wishful thinking? Inside, Gil remained standing, placing himself by the open door. He was a big man, 6'2", but thin, and somehow found a place in the narrow entryway that kept him out of the aisle as passengers and crew settled in for the flight.
"The second party has arrived," said a voice in his earpiece, and through the door Gil could see Ben and Sarah Kipling on the tarmac, showing ID to the advance men.
Then Gil felt a presence off his right shoulder and turned. It was the flight attendant holding a tray.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Did you want some champagne before we take off, or can I get you something?"
"No," he said. "Tell me your name."
"I'm Emma. Leitner."
"Thank you, Emma. I'm providing security for the Batemans. May I speak to your captain?"
"Of course. I think he's doing his walk around. Should I ask him to speak to you when he comes back?"
"Please."
"Okay," she said.
Clearly, Gil felt, something was making her nervous. But sometimes the presence of an armed man on a plane did that to people.
"I mean, can I get you anything, or—"
He shook his head, turned away, because now the Kiplings were climbing the front stairs of the plane. They had been fixtures at Bateman events over the years, and Gil knew them on sight. He nodded as they entered, but moved his gaze quickly to deter conversation. He heard them greet the others on the plane.
"Darling," said Sarah, "I love your dress."
At that moment, the captain, James Melody, appeared at the foot of the stairs.
"Did you see the fucking game?" Kipling said in a blustery voice. "How does he not catch that ball?"
"Don't get me started," said Condor.
"I mean, I could have caught that fucking ball, and I got French toast hands."
Gil moved to the top of the stairs. The fog was thicker now, blowing in trails.
"Captain," said Gil. "I'm Gil Baruch with Insular Security."
"Yes," said Melody. "They told me there'd be a detail."
He had a slight, unplaceable accent, Gil realized. British, maybe, or South African, but recycled through America.
"You haven't worked with us before," he said.
"No, but I've worked with a lot of security outfits. I know the routine."
"Good, so you know if there's a problem with the plane, or any change in the flight plan, I'll need the co-pilot to tell me right away."
"Absolutely," said Melody. "And you heard we had a change in first officer? Charles Bush is the new man, yes?"
"That's right. And you've flown with him before?"
"Once. He's not Michelangelo, but he's solid."
Melody paused for a moment. Gil could sense he wanted to say more.
"There's no such thing as an insignificant detail," he told the pilot.
"No, just, I think there may be some history between Bush and our flight attendant."
"Romantic?"
"Not sure. Just the way she acts around him."
Gil thought about that.
"Okay," he said. "Thank you."
He turned and went back inside, glancing into the cockpit as he did. Inside, Bush was in the co-pilot's seat, eating a plastic-wrapped sandwich. He looked up and met Gil's eye and smiled. He was a young man, clean-cut, but with a slight glaze to him. He'd shaved yesterday, not today. His hair was short, but unbrushed. Handsome. Gil had to watch him for only a moment to know that he'd been an athlete at some point in his life, that he'd been popular with girls since childhood, and that he liked the way it made him feel. Then Gil was turning back to the main cabin. He saw the flight attendant, Emma, approaching with an empty tray. He gestured to her with one finger. "Come here."
Hi,
she said. Is there an issue I should know about? She frowned.
I'm not...
Between you and Bush, the co-pilot. She flushed.
No, he's not... That's...
She smiled.
Sometimes they like you, she said, and you have to say no.
That's all? She fixed her hair self-consciously, aware that she had drink orders to fill.
We flew together before. He likes to flirt. With all the girls, not just... But it's fine. I'm fine.
A moment.
And you're here, she said. So...
Gil thought about that. It was his job to assess. A darkened doorway, the sound of footsteps. He was, by necessity, a connoisseur of people. He had developed his own system for knowing the types, the brooder, the nervous talker, the irascible victim, the bully, the sprite, and within those types had developed subtypes and patterns that signaled possible shifts in anticipated behavior, the circumstances under which the nervous talker might become the brooder, and then the bully. Emma smiled at him again. Gil thought about the co-pilot, the half-eaten sandwich, the captain's words. Travel time was just under an hour, gate to gate. He thought about Kipling's indictment, about the case-closed kidnapping of Robin. He thought about everything that could go wrong, no matter how far-fetched, running it all through the gray matter abacus that had made him a legend. He thought about Moshe Dayan's eye and his father's drinking, about his brother's deaths, each in turn, and the death of his sister. He thought about what it meant to live your life as an echo, a shadow, always standing behind a man and his light. He had scars he wouldn't discuss. He slept with his finger on the trigger of a Glock. He knew that the world was an impossibility, that the state of Israel was an impossibility, that every day men woke and put on their boots and went off to do the impossible, no matter what it might be. This was the hubris of mankind, to rally in the face of overwhelming odds, to thread the needle and climb the mountain and survive the storm. He thought of all of this in the time it took the flight attendant to pass, and then he got on the radio and told command that they were good to go. Countryside. Scott drives north, paralleling the Hudson past Washington Heights and Riverdale. Urban walls give way to trees and low-slung towns. Traffic stalls, then abates, and he takes the Henry Hudson Parkway past the low mall clot of Central Yonkers, shifting to Route 9, heading up through Dobbs Ferry, where American revolutionaries once camped in force, probing the Manhattan border for British weakness. He rides with the radio off, listening to the slush of his tires on the rain-slick road. A late summer thunderstorm has moved through in the last few hours, and he navigates the tail end of it, windshield wipers moving in time. He is thinking about the wave, its silent rumble, the loom of it, a towering hump of ocean brine exposed by moonlight, sneaking up on them from the rear like a giant from a children's story. Eerie and soundless it came, an enemy without soul or agency, nature at its most punishing and austere. And how he grabbed the boy and dove. His mind shifts to the image of cameras, leering mechanically, thrust forward on anonymous shoulders, judging with their unblinking convex eyes. Scott thinks of the lights in his face, the questions overlapping, becoming a wall. Were the cameras a tool for the advancement of man, he wonders, or was man a tool for the advancement of the cameras? We carried them, after all, valeting them from place to place, night and day, photographing everything we see. We believe we have invented our machine world to benefit ourselves, but how do we know we aren't here to serve it? A camera must be aimed to be a camera. To service a microphone, a question must be asked. 24 hours a day, frame after frame, we feed the hungry beast, locked in perpetual motion as we race to film it all. Does television exist for us to watch, in other words? Or do we exist to watch television? Overhead, the wave crested, teetering,
a five-story building on the verge of smooth collapse, and he dove, squeezing the boy to him, no time to take a breath. His body taking over, survival no longer trusted to the abstract functions of the mind. Legs kicking, he entered the blacks, feeling the spin cycle.